Every session, I want to summarize a bit, that we get somewhat connected to last session. And last session, we talked about duality and the central statement was that the product and the universal and the local knowledge, well, not what formally pushes to a co-product on the dual, but this co-product maps into, so to say, the completion of a tensor product of a dual spaces. And to cure this for applications, it is sufficient to consider finite dimensional representations of this dual space. And this is exactly what we want to consider today. We want to consider representations and co-representations on co-algebras and algebras. So there are many definitions today coming. And when we have fixed with that, when we have done this, we can actually come to quantization. And I hope today that at least we can take already a glimpse on quantization, because we are a bit running out of time. So, little summary. First point, we had a product on the universal enveloping algebra, and considering its dual, mu star being the co-product on the dual on the loping algebra. And actually, this happened to be this maps G tensor U of G. So the completion, and what we wanted to have is something of this sort that we have the co-product mapping on the tensor product of the duals. This we gained by our U0 of G, so it's a true sub pop algebra of U star that is isomorphic to finite dimensional representations of U star. So, what we need are representations for F, G, and there'll be these functions that map an element of the group, field K, and it's actually mapping the matrix entry of this group element in the finite dimensional representation we want to consider. Now, to give an overview.
Excuse me,
yes?
What do you mean by U not?
U naught is a sub-hop algebra of U star of G, where the co-product naught is actually a map from U0 G to the tensor product U0 of G tensor U0 of G. Yeah? There exists a true subset as a Hopf algebra. U0, U0 is a Hopf algebra. And what we want to achieve is that we do not map onto this completion, but on the separate tensor components. And it turns out later that this U0 is isomorphic to these finite dimensional representations of U0.
So U naught lives in the dual in the stars.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Uh-huh. So let's start with your presentations. So the standard situation in physics is we have a symmetry algebra, and this symmetry algebra is somehow represented on a vector space. And now we have more structure. We have not only algebras, symmetry algebras, we have entire hot algebras. And there the following happens. Let's consider we are here, the hot algebra. And we know, well, there's this algebra sector and the group algebra sector. And remind ourselves, these are made compatible by a homomorphy of the coproduct being homomorphism of the algebra sector here. This together gives a Y algebra, together with an antipode, we get again Hopf algebra. Now, we consider Hopf algebra being represented on something. So, first of all, what we will consider are on this part so called left representations and on this part. So, this is a standard situation. We have here, for example, universal enveloping algebra of Lie algebra. We have a product structure between the generators. So this is an algebraic character. And we represent that on an element of a vector space in such a way. And now we can say, no, we for example, we do not have an algebra, but a coalgebra. So there is no algebraic structure at all, only a coalgebra. And this will give a notion of a. I already take the notions dual to this part, and this is the right co representation. And of course, you can exchange that. You can also have right representations and left co-representations. You somehow have to decide, at least for one case, that is dual to another. And I just was choosing this one because this is the most usual one you are used to. And now here, in this case, we're still the representation space is yet a vector space. So this vector space, again, can be enhanced to a Hopf algebra, or at least be enhanced by an algebraic structure or a coalgebraic structure. So there are two opportunities here that we have a representation on an algebra and a representation on a coalgebra.
Do you mean a co-representation?
No, a representation.
Because you're starting with an algebra.
Yes. The representations correspond to algebras. The co-representations correspond to represented co-algebras. Yeah? So here you get representations on algebra and co-algebra. And here as well, you get co-representations on algebras and co-algebras. Because the vector space can have any additional structure being algebraic or co-algebraic. So this does not depend on a symmetry algebra you're considering, or the symmetry co-algebra, yeah, it's two parts. The algebra you want to represent can be one of these cases, And the representation space can be one of these cases.
So you're saying the vector space is an algebra or a block?
Yeah, it's all four. No. And here, the same representation on an algebra or on a coalgebra. Yeah. And what we'll need later is for functions on a dual manifold, we take right co-representations on some algebra of coordinates, for example. Yeah, so we consider it an algebra. So in this case, we are on this part and then on the algebra part. And for U of G, we consider left representations. So what we want to have is, we have algebra of coordinates that we would like to endow with symmetry. And there are two dual notions of symmetry, being universal enveloping algebra and algebra of functions. And since they are dual, the algebraic part is dual to the coalgebraic part here. So the one will be a representation, the other one a co-representation, and both of these actions are dual to another by duality we just got to know last session. Right? So, still to work. Now we get a bunch of definitions. And this will again be a bit abstract. Well, these co-representations again need some sort of formalism. It's quite similar to the definition of co-algebra. And I'll just tell you, it's something one simply has, again, to get used to. There's not much about it. It's only structure. And playing around with that will cure any difficulties. So definition of one one. Representation. The left representation of an algebra A on a vector space V is a pair. K-linear row A. This is a map from the tensor product of the algebra with the vector space into the vector space. So this is a particular way to define it, but it's exactly that representation we're used to, such that we have such elements, A and V, maps on something that I will call now an action. So this triangle is called an action. Simply to write this down, this is an element, this entire thing is an element here, the vector space. Such that the action A times B on three is equal to A on B on 3. And the one element of A acts in the following way, and B is equal to 3, of course. Then V is called left A module vector space. Just continue. We just defined this guy here, and we now go to a full representation of this. We have definition 4.2, full representation. Is a pair on either C on 3 K linear map on either C on 3 2. Now it happens. So it's similar as for the coproduct. We now share out to the tensor product of V tensor C. So now also in these representations, we got this dual structure reflected, as we know, from product and coproduct. So as we map over there the row from A tensor V to V, here with omega, we share out from V to V tensor C. Of course, we have to define what this means. And we will see this dual structure everywhere. And even in the definition of full representations, we again find the structure of the Hopf algebra axioms and the full algebra axioms. So this is very similar. So, and of course, there's a the product itself can already be considered as something as a representation, as well as the coproduct being a co-representation. They are simply specific examples for this. That's why you will find all the structure again, in principle, as we define it here. So V is now mapped again, very similar to the structure of the coproduct, so V1 tensor V2. Now, we now take upper indices here, upper extruder indices, and careful, this is an element of the symmetry coalgebra. Yeah. It's a standard of notation. One simply has to be careful here not to mess up these two components, because they are really from two different two different spaces, and it's not like the coproduct. Such that the coaction WC satisfies
V1 is still same V. V1 belongs to V, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's.
So here, derivative V1, derivative V2.
Right, and then so the vector V1 is V itself, or can be anything.
Here at this part, it's not that clearly defined what it is.
It can be any vector in V, not necessarily the V you started from on the left.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Could be anything, You somehow, you only make a statement what you consider to be a co-representation. And then, of course, you have to, for a concrete example, you have really to say what happens.
Yes.
If you here had a certain element of V, what happens on the circle? Really to define that. And it's not included here.
Okay.
Yeah, simply making a statement what we consider this to be. And we now get additional conditions on omega L, just as we got conditions on the rho A over there, omega C. So. Because we say omega C transfer identity after omega C is equal to identity transfer coproduct after omega C and identity transfer co-unit after RC is equal to identity. Now you see, this is very similar to the co-algebra structure. Yeah. But of course, because of these two different components, we now have here our co-representation and here this co-product. And this, so to say, corresponds to the co-unit axiom, but only the left-hand side. Good. This can also be written using this terminology. So this corresponds here to V1. So again, here we take the Schwedler notation for the standard profile case, and this translates to one x v two equal v. So these are the conditions for omega c to be a co-representation. And one simply has to get according to the, it's not that strange as it seems at the very first glance. And even today we will also see some example specifically for these functions and the finite dimensional representations, TAB. Now, we generalize. So, we obtain these two parts. Now I want to come to these guys. So we have somehow to become more specific. We start from these definitions, and now we have to add conditions to get representations and full representations straight for representation spaces that are algebras or co-algebras. And later, in our specific example, we of course have entire Hopf algebras, but nevertheless, we only consider one type of representation or co-representation. We will not use them both in the meantime, although one might think that one could use them in the meantime. Maybe one can, but we are not using this. Let's directly start. V is called right. C co-module vector space. Specifically now consider representations. I will take some sort of short notation. So we have here a representation.
So your first on is it off?
On?
Your first on is it off?
On and.
Oh, okay.
Representation of a top. So this is again through Leibniz rule, we are already used. We also have to define what happens if we act on the one element of the other one, A. And H acting on one will be the co-unit of H. Let me start over with the definition of my form. Representation.
I'm sorry?
Yep.
Just for the definition 4.3, we see H as a top algebra. So when it acts on an algebra, the result should be in what space exactly?
In the algebra.
Okay.
So these are elements of the algebra, and this is a product of the algebra.
Okay. So then for the acting on the identity, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Thank you. becoming a bit more interesting. The co-product of H acting on C is equal to sum H acting on C1 tensor H2 acting on C2. And the co-unit H acting on C will be the product of the co-units. This one. Why the tensor product?
Oh,
it's a co-unit only. You are here mapped into the co-algebra. I mean, on one single element of the co-algebra, and you can then add the co-unit on it. So this is a number in the field. Good, it sounds C. C is called H module and so 4.2 co-representations. A co-representation of the Hopf graph on will be defined the following way. So again, we have this omega. We have somehow to say what is omega on the product of two elements of the algebra has to result. And this is simply omega h of a plus omega h of b. And again, for one element, omega h shall be 1 in the algebra. No. Yes, in the algebra times 1 in the hot algebra. Because it's the right one. So a is called right. H module algebra so the last one now we want this we got on the upper blackboard, here we are on the lower blackboard, and so this one is left, a co-representation on the co-algebra.
So, I understand that this omega h a times b, right? Omega h is mapping from Yes, pretends, right. And then you're taking the dot product with the omega h.
Yeah, so tensor component times tensor component. Always. Always here. So maybe I'll write this we have here. A1 transfer A2 times B1 transfer B2 will show you the same as A1 times B1 transfer A2 times B2.
That's a bit confusing in this notation because it can mean two things. I mean, suppose your index is one here, so it's not clear, but suppose the index on A, there was a sum, and the index was I, and then the index on B was J, for example. You wouldn't want a sum that, like, your index on B could be different than your index on A, whereas none of those are the same thing.
As I told you, they are not yet indices. Yeah. The index for A, the second, for example, here in this part, the second index of A is completely different than the second index of B. This is well defined. You can distinguish this. I did not write a sum over an index I or J anywhere. You have to, when you have the omega defined, really defined, then you can do that.
Yeah.
Here it only means what components of the omega are mapped where and multiplied with which what components of the other part.
Yes. But, I mean, there's somehow an ambiguity.
In what sense? I don't see that.
In the sense that you could see it as 1A being multiplied with only 1B, or 1A multiplied with all the Bs. That's what's not clear.
So, I mean, multiplying this one with these two, or all?
No. So there's many, say in the D1, there's many of them, right?
There's a sum, yes.
Yeah, there's a sum.
So B1, B2, there's a sum.
Yeah, so on the left most A, A is going to be multiplied with all the Bs in the sum.
Yes.
Okay, but yes. In that notation, it's not clear. It looks a bit as if A is multiplied with only the first one.
No. Not at all. This is really a sum. So here you can really get something, a sum over one index, and then you have somehow, let's write this down. Maybe I do this for the coproduct. We virtually have the same problem. So coproduct of a generator of the universe and we're looking at what we also have this sum, G, first component, second component. And, well, now we evaluate the sum, and it's G I tensor 1 plus 1 tensor G I. So, of course, if now I have a product, so for homomorphy, for example, and this guy, where K, so I write G I, maybe I write G J, and GJ has this, for example, a very simple example, has the same coproduct, then of course, component by component, then I will, here, every component of the sum will be multiplied with the other one, of course. This is answered.
So for this one it was clear, but this notation is not clear. And
it's absolutely the same.
Okay. Can I ask the same question for the definition 4.4? Could we write that you have coproduct of H applied on C? Could we write it as coproduct of H applied on coproduct of C? Could we write it that way?
On the first glance, formally, I would say yes, but I'm not sure that I tell the truth now.
So,
yeah. I know what you mean, that you can write it in such a way times H. see, something like that.
Yeah.
I'm currently not, well, of course, it looks this way. I'm not sure whether this is possible.
So
at first glance, it is, yeah.
So the question is, say the first one of H1, is it applied on many Cs? Or is it
on all the C1s, yes.
On all C1s?
Yes, exactly. So maybe if you write, well, I think you can do the following. You can write this down, and by this definition, define what the action of the on the tensor or the product structure actually is. Yeah. So now we have 4.6 definition. So this is the last one. We have a co-representation. Co-product transfer identity after omega h. So now it becomes Anderson identity transfer product after identity transfer sigma. Transfer identity. Here, sigma is again the transposition map. After omega h, tensor omega h, after product on C. Yes, this is a right action that we apply. Yes, this is a co-algebra. Yes. Okay, this works. And of course, we can write this down in our special notation. This one. You meant this H?
Yeah.
Sorry, this word. C is called right? Cool. Mm-hmm.
Is there a meaning to the fact that the indices are different
from lower indices? Yeah, it distinguishes whether you apply the co-product, wherever you write the indices downstairs, or whether you apply the co-action, wherever you write them upstairs. So the writing here means that, for example, in this specific C, we first apply a co-action, and afterwards a co-product on the element.
Shouldn't there be an applied somewhere? Because on the left side, you have a map which, as an input, takes something in the co-algebra.
Mm-hmm.
So you should have the same thing on the right-hand side.
Yes. No, here you have something on the algebra, on the Hopf algebra. Because with the epsilon, here you're coming from C mm-hmm. to C tensor H, applying this one. Then you apply the co-unit on the co-algebra part of the tensor product. So the result, and this gives you a number that you can put through the tensor product.
Right.
So you end up in H. And this is the number you're multiplying. Yeah. So this is applied on the co-algebra part of this map. Yeah, so again, this gives you some C tensor H. I use the notation C1 tensor C2, where this belongs to H, and this belongs to the co-algebra here. It's a bit small, sorry. Can you see it? And so this belongs to the Hopf algebra, this belongs to the co-algebra. Then we apply this guy. The co-unit is applied to the first component. Yeah. And here we have the identity on the Hopf algebra. So this one belongs to the Hopf algebra. And this is the co-unit we took from this. First part is giving us a number that we can put through the tensor product. Very simply, because it's a tensor product, let's say, remove the k numbers. Ask, simply ask. It's okay? Good. So now, what we will use is definition 4.5 for our algebras of functions on group manifold, and definition 4.3 we'll use for universal looping algebra.
So you took these two examples because they're relevant for physics or for something, in fact. For FG, we take the representation of an algebra for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Later on, you, for example, on the representation space, we are later able to write down the computation relations between coordinates in terms of the R matrix. And this R matrix is a result from such a co-representation. As we will shortly see, I will demonstrate this in the next part. And deforming the product here, with the help of the R matrix, this down pushed, this R matrix is down pushed to the representation space, and that results in a non-commutativity that is described by conjugation with this R matrix. So this is really a guy we will need. And it will look the following way. We have here, again, such an omega, and we'll apply it on maybe some coordinate xa. And now this has to push out in exactly this way. And it's made quite simple. So it's a right action. And this will be some xb tensor tab. So we have a matrix, some sort of matrix multiplication from the right. Well, tensor multiplication. And but this is, of course, that what you want to have in physics. Only in, for a physicist, a bit strange notation. But you can here, for this example, more or less consider the tensor product as some sort of product. And this, of course, will be dual to the notion of the representation of the universal envelope form. And I just come to that. So by the duality we just learned in the last session, we can push a representation, a left representation, to a right co-representation in the dual space, or the dual symmetry algebra. And we remain with the same, of course, with the same representation space, representation algebra. And so it's only shifting between two sorts of representations depending on what we just want to consider, whether we want to be in this guy, deal with R matrices, or we want to be in the universal enveloping algebra, dealing, for example, with a twist element or a quasi-triangular structure. Depends simply what in physics you want to apply. That's why we need all this to get this straight. Because in the literature and physics, you find both. You will really find.
Right, because in physics, maybe we are more used to using universal enveloping algebras than functions on the group manifold of symmetries, for example. Yeah. I mean, use all the time combination of two elements of the algebra symmetries, but you know, we'll really
Here it looks as if, well, we have these two different dual notions of symmetries, and they were invented in the same moment. Historically, I think it was in such a way that first these functions on the group manifold were known. And because we once started with R matrices, the R matrix was somehow coming out of some physical applications, I don't know, computing some scattering amplitudes and so forth. I don't know this in detail. And with this, it started. And then people were coming up with universal enveloping algebras, probably not really connected to that at the very first glance, but of course, had to be somehow dual to another, because they were virtually describing the same thing. They were simply dual perspectives on the same thing. So somewhere, it should have been able to write down a dual pairing, and somebody did so. Mm-hmm. And now I'm presenting you, okay, there are these two, and they're dual, and this is how it works. But historically, it developed another way. And I think this is also the reason why you find both notions in the literature. I think I also like much more working with the universal enveloping algebra. But older literature is using virtually only these functions on the group manifold, nothing else. But for physics, it really turns out to be a good choice to use these universal enveloping algebras, also because of the elements that deform later the coproduct, because it contains much more information than the R matrix. The R matrix, well, the quasi-triangular structure is an exponent in the tensor product of a symmetry algebra. So there's a lot of structure. You can deform entire power series in the universe of developing algebra with this single operator, and thus contains all the information that is inherent to the entire deformation. But going to this part, you somehow insert matrix representations into the quasi-triangular structure, and then sum it up. You sum up the whole exponential function to one single matrix. And there you actually, at least on the first glance, you are losing information. Because if you now want, again, this R matrix describes you how two coordinates are commuted, but not more. They do not tell you what monomials of coordinates are commuted. For this, you have to use the R matrix and again compute it. And again, you get these power series of operators that you formally lost summing up the quasi-triangular structure. So it's sometimes much more useful to stay in the universe and look at the picture because of information. So standard situation in physics is we have an algebra of coordinates. And that is generated. This algebra. There again, this is again the tensor algebra that's divided by some relations and by a two-sided ideal, where you again have some relations xA times xB minus xB times xA being equal something. I'm equal zero, for example, for the non-commutative case. And you can also say, OK, we take this first of all as a vector space, and we can say for the commutative case, for example, there's we declare a bracket, Lie bracket, equals zero. And then this is again something, or it is a universal enveloping algebra of this vector space. So it is. In the physics literature, people always distinguish between such algebra of coordinates and universal enveloping algebras. And from the algebraic point of view, there is no difference. It is the same thing. But the only difference that can result later is you will not establish a co-algebra structure. You're usually not doing that. And of course, in general, on the universal enveloping algebra, you can do that. So, but from the algebraic point of view, it's the same object. It has the same structure inside.
And if you choose the non-commutative case, if the bracket there is non-zero, it's not the last part, it's not true. anymore?
Then it's still a universal envelope map. See it like this.
Yeah, you just
consider this a consider this a two vector space, k vector. And you just defined a Lie bracket. Then you check the axiomatics, that's anti-semantic, bilinear, and Jacobian identity. Then you have a true Lie bracket, and from this you can always define yourself a universal envelope algebra from this assumptions.
Any Lie bracket, even if
you have any Lie bracket, yes, of course, there is no actual difference. A vector space or Lie bracket could be
okay.
So, I personally like much more to give it such a name because it keeps clear what it actually is. Some of our physicists distinguish between universal enveloping algebra of their symmetry algebra and this algebra of coordinates, but formally it is, there's no difference. Here we have some additional copula structure, okay, but algebraically it's the same.
UG? That's UG?
UG?
Of the symmetries of the...
Yes. They somehow distinct for the symmetries, they're always using the notion of U of G. And for the coordinates, they're using this notion here. But formally, there's not really a difference.
Uh-huh.
On the symmetries, you of course have, again, the coproduct structure. And you will not introduce this here. But anyway, from the algebraic point of view, it's quite the same. And that's why I personally like much more to do this here. Of course, if it's commutative, it's the same thing as real numbers in principle. It's, algebraically, it's isomorphic. Nevertheless, you can also consider some finite dimensional Hilbert space instead. Right. From the structure, it's quite the same. It depends what you want to do. So it's a bit more general than formal powers, than power series. Let's say formal power series and real coordinates. All right. And okay, now, what we want to learn now is we want to represent G of G and G of G. Represent F of G of little g here, Lie algebra. This universal enveloping algebra of Lie algebra.
Which
G? Any. Well, this, we consider the case that we want to represent a symmetry somehow, some representation space. I do not want to specify that this is now a Lorentz algebra or Frank-Hilbert algebra. It's some.
Okay, so coordinates belong to the manifold, and
we
have
some
transmission
as
a manifold. I
didn't understand this question.
You took with coordinates, so what
kind of objects are
these?
This one.
Or
as
x
to begin.
Yeah.
You can consider this. Let's say X is a vector space. So there are vectors, you can add vectors.
I think the question is, physically, are they supposed to be the coordinates of space-time or the coordinates of the Lie
If they commute, you can always decide that they're tangent space.
What is the physical picture? In the physical picture, what am I supposed to interpret X as being?
Yeah, you can, for all the cores, you can interpret this as coordinates.
Of space-time or the Lie algebra, the Lie manifold?
Of space-time. Yeah.
And then G?
Symmetry.
This time?
Yeah.
Like Lorentz group?
For example. Or Lorentz algebra, let's say. This has the magnitude of the Lorentz group, but we are always dealing with monomials in the Lie algebra.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and now comes to relate them duly, we need the following lemma, 4.7. Lemma. Mm-hmm. the H be a finite dimensional it's better for all of them. It's not only for finite dimensional half algebras. As long as you can define the pairing that I will introduce, you can do it also for infinite case. There is some restriction. So let H be a hop of one. And H star, it's dual. Then a right coaction beta V one cancel V two in V cancel H star. Is equivalent to a left action of H on the and they are related. Formula H acting on a B is equal to the sum V1 dual pair V2 comma H. Or in other words, a left H module algebra is a right H star comodule. So this will help us to do the dual mapping between these two notions, between the representation of G of G and the representation of F of G. This will this job. And I think I have to abbreviate a bit. So let's see. Yeah. We can now, in this particular case, we have now U of G represented on X that we know that GI acting on X angle is equal to XB. So we have finite dimensional here, and we have a matrix representation of U of G.
Did you define what the commodule
means? Pardon?
Did you define what the commodule means?
The commodule, yes. Here,
oh.
If you have a coaction.
Right there, H commodule out.
Yeah. This is a comorbid.
Yeah, that was a comorbid.
Sorry. Yeah. And I already told you that functions are these EAB. G to field K and T A B G I shall be equal to G I A. And then we have it, because now we say that T A B G is the dual pairing G A B on G. This is very important to remember. This we'll use all the time. This is what really relates one side to the other.
I'm not clear about the T, A, I or something. Because on T being better. Because this is a group, an actual group, so are you kind of a function on the group doesn't, I don't see why it necessarily has to be linear or anything.
Suppose it's defined here. Because we want to have this duality and we restrict it to being linear. It has, of course, when you just define it, it's not necessarily linear, but we want it to be linear because we want to define our pairing by this way. It's like in the duality session on Monday. We are just restricting our linear functions to get a dual pairing. This is, so to say, the strategy to do that. Now, good. Actually, I wanted to show you a bit how one is really computing over, how one is really pushing the code action to the action and vice versa. I will neglect that just a moment. We are already late. I really want to start with conjugation to get this through tomorrow. And I want to finish today with F of G. I will just introduce the Hopf algebra structure, but I will not prove it. It's rather simple. And then continue with quantization. Do you want to see quantization a bit today? Shall we prolong a bit the session? Depends on you. Yes? Okay. So I just write down F of G, the Hopf algebra, the coalgebra. So a coproduct is defined GA. E is equal to T a C tensor T C V. So this, the coproduct here contains the matrix multiplication.
I do want to interrupt you in the middle of that. Just to come back to the previous line, I'm sorry about this. Isn't the pairing supposed to define an element in K?
Yes.
And right now, T, the function T applied to G, is actually an element in G.
No. It's a matrix representation. This is an element in K.
Oh, okay. So you're actually taking that component.
Yes, exactly. This is the specific definition of this function. Yeah. But the coalgebra structures only define all the functions themselves. So this is again the way. Let's see this way. So the full unit T A T B is T A B of the one element, the chronic delta delta B, and the antipode. So now careful. Here I was using elements of the algebra, but actually we are talking about functions on the group. So of course there is no inverse for this element. So only if we take exponentials of the algebra, then we can say some inverse will be. So the antipode, and that's why this is really a function on the group manifold, not on the Lie algebra. The antipode can only be defined on the group. Yeah?
So I forgot for big G to find
you can consider capital G as a Lie group, and in this picture insert their exponentials in the universal enveloping algebra because they are actually group elements.
Okay.
For computations we do exactly that.
Capital G there is now an G.
This one?
Yeah.
This shall now be an element of that writing. Let's take small g and put a hat on. And this is another element of the group.
But you also have, when you had the t applied to the small g, that was also called and not
here.
Yeah.
In principle, yes. But nevertheless, we later need matrix representations of the Lie algebra itself. To for example, sum up the quasi-triangular structure to sum our matrix. So as long as we do not enhance it with an antipode, we can still do that here. But of course, if we want to consider inverse elements, then we really have to go to the group. And that's why it's really the functions on the group and nothing else. It's not the functions on the Lie algebra. What in principle we could also define, but do not need.
So I didn't understand what the component P I.
We assume that we have the group is represented on X. We already assume this exists. We assume the representation exists. Yeah. So we do not worry about whether there exists some representation, what properties it has. We already assume that it exists, and then we can define such functions that map to the matrix.
And is it represented as linear operator?
These?
Is it a group? The group is represented as these properties?
The functions T are linear, just to get rid of the pairing.
Okay. Yeah. So I think the question is the group here is a 4x4 matrix.
For Lorentz groups, okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Suppose it was the Lorentz group,
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Suppose our space-time, our x.
Yeah, exactly. You really take the matrix representation, you really have your lambda, and you're inserting it, yeah? It's really what one does. Yeah. For example, for this constant theta case, where you have this commutator x mu equal I theta mu mu, this is some constant isometric tensor, there you they have the Lorentz algebra somehow acting, you deform the Lorentz algebra, and then you want to go to the other side, to the dual notation f of g. Then you're really taking the representations of the generators of the Lorentz group in the matrix representation as you know from theory. Yeah. Exactly. And so let me finish here. So this is g to the minus 1. And the AB component. And this we will define to be the t minus 1 AB of g hat. All right. Sorry, it's quite important, but now slow part of the example. Good. So let's have a short glimpse on quantization. In principle, it's a matrix multiplication. So, okay, let's start with and we start with some overview. And in this overview, I want to emphasize on U of G, just to get the ideas straight, and then later we come also to the functions. And what does it mean to quantize the universal Hilbert notion? Quantization means to relax commutativity. So remember the coproduct here for a constant moment, this is gi tensor 1 plus 1 tensor gi. And of course, we can now apply the transposition map on this. This means we just change tensor components, and of course, we get the same coproduct again. This is equal to sigma after coproduct, where sigma again is defined. So it's simply reversing the order. It's nothing particular. And quantizing U of G means to relax that condition, that exchanging the tensor components of the coproduct will result in something a bit different. And technically, one is doing that by conjugating with some element of the tensor product of H tensor H, and in this case, of the tensor product of U, G, tensor U, G. So one example, so non-co-commutative means this is not the same map. So, and therefore we have the quasi-triangular structure for the first example. And here, so the default co-product in this case are on some element H, so H start of this top algebra, is equal to the undeformed co-product. So there, it seems, everything seems all right. But now,
You should maybe write GI also on the right hand side of the top. But, you know, you have to put copper and GI by Z sigma copper GI on the right hand side. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Shouldn't there be GI?
Ah, sorry, yeah. Yes. And now? It happens that transposition map. So now we are checking for co-commutativity, and the following thing shall happen: that this is equal to some invertible element R times the co-product of H times the inverse of R.
What do you mean by
R?
What's R?
R is an element of H tensor H. And it's again here a tensor component times tensor component.
So you're redefining the sigma?
Redefining. No, I'm rather redefining, if one wants to call it this way, the copula.
But it's equal to that, at least. It's equal to the original co-product, so it's already defined. Okay, but if it's not co-commutative now.
Well, these are not the same. Well, these two guys are not the same anymore. No. Because of what is
it? That equal for any age? The action of the co-product is equal to the same as the action of the initial for any element.
I don't understand the question.
The co-product is defined by what it does in H, right?
You have your co-product is already defined. It's some co-product already defined, co-commutative. And now we say quantizing means to introduce a new co-product that is non-co-commutative.
Also, the new co-product both are defined by what they do in H, right?
The confusing part is that you put coproduct R H equal to coproduct H, which you define the whole way.
So you're saying that the old one, the new one, is the same as the new, the old one. Yes.
I understand. This may be a bit confusing, but somehow I have to write it down.
And if the old one was co-commutative, there's no reason why the new one wouldn't be. It's equal to the same thing.
Yeah, it just means that but you have to make a choice. One, it's an anti-symmetric definition somehow. One expression of the co-product is still the same one as the co-commutative one. It's the same expression. But then you have the rule that if you transpose, that this expression will be to this conjugated version. Yeah.
So it's true only for a subset of the element of H, right? Which subset? This equality is true only for a subset.
No. Sorry, I'm confusing you. What I want to express here, you start with a co-commutative co-product. And then you say, I want to have a non-co-commutative one. And I define it in such a way that first I take the result of applying this co-product and assigning it to my new co-product. And then I say, okay, now I'm switching components.
The
And this result of switching the component shall be this one.
You do that for which iteration?
Hmm?
For which?
It's
defining. It hasn't defined
yet.
For which little h
we do that? For h operation.
Which one?
Everyone.
Everything.
You can?
Sure.
You just, what do you say? What you're changing is the definition of sigma. You change the definition of the.
Okay, that thing.
If you want to, yeah.
Would you have
to change sigma? Yeah, one could also say it this way.
That is true. So you deform it.
If you want to, yeah. But yeah. We're not writing this way.
And just a technicality, the R, shouldn't it be element of H tensor H star?
No. Why?
Well, because it's applied on.
It's multiplied.
It's multiplied.
Oh.
Here you have a tensor product, and then tensor component times tensor component.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. It's not so much about it, simply conjugating with this element from H to H. Right? And now.
So what does R minus 1 mean?
R minus 1 means that R times R is equal to 1 tensor 1.
That always exists.
Well, you have to take an R where this exists. Because you cannot write this down. And this is already part of the definition for the quasi triangular structure. So you can only take one where this is written. And so I finished with the Grenfell twist. It's another way to introduce a quantization, but also it results in a non-commutativity. And there we have that the cooperite match is directly conjugated. An element minus one, but again, it's invertible. Yeah. So you directly take the cooperite and conjugate it this way. It's not this anti-symmetric definition somehow, but directly it does a conjugation. And in this case, the antipode map is not changed, but in this one. Yeah. And I would say, you see this tomorrow. Okay, that's it for today.